Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that makes using different currencies easy. With Wise, you can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate. There are no hidden fees either. See exactly what you'll pay up front, every time. Join 16 million customers already saving with Wise. To learn how Wise could work for you, download the app or visit wise.com.
He would appear in the dark.
Handing, literally handing.
He was a killer.
World of Secrets, Season 3, The Apartheid Killer. Listen now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Claudia Hammond. Welcome to The Evidence from the BBC, where we take a topic and delve into the research to learn what we can all do to live a healthy life. Now, this series is produced in collaboration with Wellcome Collection, and we are back in their beautiful reading room in London with a live audience. It is wonderful to be back here, and today we are looking at salt. It's a cheap foodstuff that most of us eat every day, but once upon a time, salt was one of the world's most valuable commodities, and with good reason. It is crucial to our health. It can preserve food, and also, of course, it tastes good. But there is plenty more that science can tell us about salt and how to get just the right amount for good health. So to help us learn about salt's mysteries, let me introduce my panel. We have Penn Vogler, who is a food historian and author of the best-selling book Scoff, A History of Food and Class in Britain. We have Dr. Andrea Seller, who's a professor of chemistry at University College London. And joining us from Nigeria is Dr. DK Oji, who is a practicing cardiologist, and he's head of the cardiovascular research unit at the University of Abuja. Please join me in welcoming our panel to The Evidence today. Now, before I speak to our panel, I have a question for the audience. Who here likes to eat salty foods, maybe chips or crisps or a cheeky salty margarita or maybe even anchovies? Can you please cheer if you like a salty snack?
Yay!
Oh, gosh, I think that was nearly everybody. Is there anyone here who's willing to tell me what their favourite salty snack is and why they like it? Yes, there's somebody in the second row just here.
I do love a salt-rimmed margarita. I love salt so much, I'll literally just dab my finger in and eat salt straight. No food.
Anybody else want to tell us what they like? Yeah.
Salt on chips, of course.
Lovely. Very nice. Very nice. Anyone else? Yes, over the other side, if you can get to there, Andy.
I have no sense of smell, so salt on everything makes it tastier.
Oh, that's interesting. So it's actually improving that for you. Well, thank you very much. So it does seem as though salt is quite popular. Penn, let me start with you. Why do we eat salt? Do we need to eat it or do we just eat it because it does taste good?
It tastes good. We do need to have salt, but do we need to eat it? That's a really interesting question. And history suggests that people who have got their calories from hunting, you know, we're talking mostly quite a long time ago, maybe the Paleolithic, the eons before people started farming. There's very little evidence that people, you know, added salt to their food. And it's thought that they had enough salt from the meat and maybe sometimes the milk as well that they got directly. And actually, when people have studied kind of Inuit diets or the diets of Maasai, for example, in Africa, it's the same. So hunting peoples tend not to manufacture salt to add to food. And then there's a massive shift in the kind of record that as soon as people start farming, they start adding salt. And it's probably for two reasons. One is that vegetables wouldn't have enough salt in it, and so they feel maybe intuitively that they need to add it. But also, if you're farming, you need to start preserving food, and that's obviously where salt has that kind of completely magic ability to keep milk as cheese, you know, meat, fish, and even vegetables and fruit. You know, all those things are salted. So our ability to salt food is a very, very long-standing one.
And Andrea, why is it so important? What function does salt play in the body?
Well, you know, we are essentially electrical beings, but we're not electrical beings the way we normally learn about electricity in school, and that is wires. Electricity is fundamentally a chemical process in which charged particles move. And in this case, we're talking about ions. So sodium ions, potassium ions are absolutely fundamental. And the way we find them is in the form of what we now call salts. So the word salt, which starts out as rock salt, and chemists would call sodium chloride, actually to a chemist becomes a kind of metaphor for something much wider. And so, yes, they're absolutely fundamental building blocks of biology.
And DK, what happens if we don't get enough salt?
If we don't get enough salt, then that is what we call hyponatremia. It means low sodium in the blood. And what that will lead to is much accumulation of water in the cells and the tissues. Because if you don't have enough sodium within the blood vessels, then water tends to seep out of those blood vessels now into the tissues. And by the time the salt level continues to reduce, then the person can come with symptoms. So it can have like headaches. Sometimes the person can even get confused. People have gone into coma before if the sodium level is too low.
So it's a serious problem if you're too low in salt, but there are also health problems from eating too much salt. DK, what does it do to our bodies if we have too much salt in our diets?
So if we have too much salt in our diet, it eventually leads to high blood pressure. When you have a lot of salt within the blood vessel, there will be a lot of sodium. It will attract water, and that leads to high blood pressure. When someone has high blood pressure, it can lead to heart attacks because the high blood pressure tends to damage the blood vessels that are supplying the heart, what we call the coronary arteries. It can also lead to stroke because this high blood pressure also tends to damage the blood vessels supplying the brain, what we call the cerebral vessels. So if salt is too much, it can lead to high blood pressure. And high blood pressure causes a lot of complications, what we call cardiovascular diseases.
So it sounds as though it's really important to have enough salt, but not too much salt. And later on, we'll talk about the exact amount that's needed. Now, as a presenter of programs on health, I make it my mission to do whatever it takes to bring you the best information on whatever subject we're covering. And so since we're talking about salt, I felt it was crucial to get a really thorough first-hand understanding of how salt affects the food we eat. So to do that, I visited an award-winning restaurant called Prithvi, which is in Cheltenham in the southwest of England, and I met the owner, Jay Rahman, and just possibly headed to the kitchen for a small bite to eat.
The restaurant started back in 2012 with just a will to cook really good food, but really good Indian food. It's evolved over time, and now headed by Chef Tom, the vision is to use Indian spices in the most delicate possible way, to marry that with European techniques, modern techniques, so using water bath, chondro, barbecue, yeah.
And how important a part would you say that salt plays in Indian cooking generally?
I think in any cooking, really, salt is essential. You know, salt, it just brings everything to life. You know, if you try something with salt and without salt, it's a whole lot of difference, yeah.
Well, it looks lovely what's being made today, and Tom Law is the head chef here, and I think he's going to make something for us.
So the dish essentially is a saffron-cured chalk stream trout.
So you've got a huge container of salt there with some other things in it as well. Yeah, what else
so
is in there?
This is half salt, half sugar, and then we've got saffron, fennel seeds, mustard seeds, coriander seeds. And that's what we cure the trout in for this dish here, isn't it?
And here you have some beautiful sides of trout. How many trout are in this dish?
So this is two whole trout.
Wow.
I'm only going to use two fillets, though, for the purposes of this today. So basically the salt and sugar will draw out all of the moisture while seasoning it and cooking it.
So you've just poured masses of salt onto that, and you're making sure it's on both sides and it's completely covered.
So we then leave this for 24 hours. And what will happen is you won't be able to see any of the salt in the tray. It'll just be liquid that's come out of the fish. And then to replace the liquid is the flavours from the salt, if you see. So this is the product you end with, if you see.
Oh, I see,
so
yeah.
So this has been cured for a day, dried for a day, and then sliced, and then that's it. So we've got a pickled cucumber, which is here, with a dill pickle. And we've got
lovely.
Some crispy fish skin.
Oh, look at that.
Buttermilk, which helps cut through all of the flavours, the saltiness and the sweetness. Cut through the creaminess from the buttermilk. And then this sauce is Makni sauce, which is tomato based, and it's got cashew nuts and bits and pieces in there. Alright, so do you want to taste this dish now?
Yes, please, definitely. I think in the name of science, it's only right that I taste fair. It. Yeah.
So go for it.
It's forked to try a bit of it. Let me try this. I want to get all these different things. Oh! That is really nice. Now, what's interesting is this doesn't taste... I wouldn't say all this tastes really salty.
No, it's
and
just balanced.
And yet, loads of these things have salt in
There's
them.
There's plenty of salt. Everything on that plate has salt in it in some form or another. The thing is, I think that you would notice that dish more if it didn't have the salt in it. It would taste not good. You see what I mean? So everything needs the salt in it, and then it all just marries together.
Is there something you could use as an alternative to having so much salt in this, or do you think can't be done?
I wouldn't bother looking into it, to be honest with you. I've been a chef for like 20 years, so imagine how much salt I've used in my life.
yeah.
You only notice salt when it's not there, if you see what I mean. It's the way that we like to be able to cook, because if something's bland, then it's game over, isn't it? We're wasting our time. So it's very important, salt.
And some people don't add salt to their cooking, say, at home, because
they're trying to be
like healthy.
Like my mum, for example.
Oh, yeah.
She's getting better now, to be honest with you, but...
What, you're persuading her to add a bit more salt?
Yeah. She's realised that life's too short to eat bland food all the time.
Well, thanks to Chef Tom there, and we'll talk later about whether life is too short to be careful how much salt you eat or not. But Andrea, that recipe, which was delicious, involved curing the trout instead of cooking it. But what is curing? What's the chemical process that happens when you smother something like that in loads of salt?
Well, this really connects very much with what DK was talking about before, and that is the fact that when you dissolve salt into water, one of the things you do is you actually change the behavior of the water. And so if you sprinkle salt onto the surface of fish or an aubergine or whatever, there is then a difference between the water on the outside and the water inside the cells of whatever it is you've sprinkled it on. And what's really interesting is that the effect of the salt is to actually make the water less active, let's say. So it will evaporate less, whereas the water which is inside, right, is unchanged in a sense. And therefore, it tends to come out. And so this is really fundamental, because what it means is that having a balance of concentration on the inside and on the outside of cells is absolutely critical because of this phenomenon called osmosis. And so osmosis is the process by which water will move across boundaries in response to concentrations of salts. And so, in fact, salt is so tightly bound up with biology that a chemist called Peter Mitchell came up with a kind of chemiosmotic theory to try and explain, in a sense, what life is and what drives it. And it's really all about concentrations of salt and the movement of water.
And Penn, how important was it to human history, this ability to be able to cure meat or fish and be able to preserve it? Did that shape human history in a way?
It shaped entire the global history, because you cannot have an empire without salt. So if you control where the salt is produced so that your soldiers get salted food that can keep them going on the marches, then they, as the Romans discovered when they kind of took over Europe, they have an advantage. So most people know the word salary comes from that. It comes from the money that people paid to soldiers so that they could buy their salt. And therefore the word soldier also comes from that. So it has these enormous kind of shaping mechanisms. The Spanish, who took over South America, of course, made sure they had control over every bit of salt works, and that gave them complete control over South and Central America. And then, of course, the most famous example, perhaps, is in Britain anyway, is the salt tax that Britain used. And so Britain preferred not to tax its own salt because it wanted to support its salt production. And the British Empire taxed salt in India, again, to protect the domestic salt situation. And this was what's behind Gandhi's salt march, because Gandhi said it's immoral, it's sinful to tax an essential something. You know, it'd be fine to tax, you know, sugar or tea or something you don't actually need, but this is something that we need to keep us going. And so this very famous salt march, where he walks 240 miles to the coast, picks up some salt. It's a very symbolic act of disobedience to the British Empire, the thing that showed this is what Indians need and this is what you're preventing us from having. So salt has this incredible kind of role in world history.
And over the centuries, have we changed the types of salt that we value the most?
That's a really interesting question, because initially, usually it's the thing that you can't have that's the thing you value, like white bread was the thing that people valued, and also white salt was the thing that people valued. Pure, fine-flowing, free-flowing salt, the stuff you get in a kind of plastic bottle now and costs 30p or whatever it is from the supermarket. And then the sort of, you know, crystalline, maybe grey, maybe pink salt that was called bay salt, often produced by solar evaporation rather than mined, that was seen as kind of less, had lower status. And so quite often recipes would call for bay salt, as it was often called, to be used in preservation. But it was the finer, whiter, the better the salt was. And that would be the thing on the salt cellar in the middle of the table.
Now, Andrea, that fish dish that I tasted had, you know, I saw so much salt poured all over that to cure it in that way, and yet it didn't taste that salty. Well, why is that?
Well, that's right, because the salt really stays on the outside. It isn't able to penetrate into the dish if it's done properly. And so it has the effect, essentially, of dehydrating the fish and therefore, in a way, concentrating the flavour.
So does food that has lots of salt in it always necessarily taste salty?
I would say yes, but there's no question that your perception of saltiness depends on the context that you eat things in. And so it is possible to mask salt if you have other things around it.
So, DK, this is interesting if you can't necessarily tell how salty something is. Is that a problem health-wise? Because if you're trying not to eat too much salt, you might not really know whether you are.
Yeah, it depends on the context. I mean, if you cook at home, you will know the level of salt you add to your food. If you are eating at a restaurant, of course, the general rule we cardiovascular physicians give is that, please, there should not be no table salt. So it really depends. But having said that, there are a number of individuals that don't have very sensitive taste buds. So that can be an issue for them. And for example, if you have been used to much salt, your taste buds get conditioned to a lot of salt. Then naturally, also maybe genetically, people have different levels of taste buds. So that can be an issue. But it really depends on the context.
And Andrea, I was intrigued to see that there's a new device out in Japan, which is a salt spoon, and it's got a small electrical charge on it that makes the food taste saltier than it really is. How would that work?
I mean, it's an absolutely amazing thing. It's a wonderful device. It's a spoon, and it's got a little battery in it, and what it delivers is a tiny sort of voltage in a sense, and so you get some kind of sensation in the mouth. Now, this isn't at all surprising in a way. I wonder how many people in the audience listening, when they were children, maybe as adults, touched their tongues to a 9-volt battery, right? did you do that? I mean, it's in the list of dangerous experiments for boys.
We're not suggesting it, by the way.
Well, I mean, I think everyone should try it once. I mean, you know, it's kind of... But actually, I mean, this has a really ancient connection because the discovery of the original connection between chemistry and electricity came from an Italian scientist, Alessandro Volta, who started putting different metals into salty liquids in glasses and then linking them up with wires. And he was interested in this phenomenon of electricity, and the only way he had to detect it was by touching it against his tongue. And he was quite astonished because he got a little bit of a jolt. And then he put two of these cups, and then he put three, and he called them a crown of cups. And each time he put another one in, the jolt got bigger. But he also noticed that there was a taste associated with it. And he thought, my God, there's a connection between chemistry, electricity, and the senses. So at that point, he put one wire against his tongue and the other one in his ear. And this time he got the jolt, the taste, and a sound in his ear. Well, he did the obvious experiment that I'm sure all of you are thinking of, and that is to hook up his tongue with his eyeball, right?
Oh, no.
And now he got the jolt, the taste, and a flash. And he reported this in a letter to Joseph Banks that was reported in 1800. And that really set off an incredible train of excitement in chemistry. And chemists have been, I think, putting their tongues to batteries ever since.
That is one I'm not trying. The eyeball one, I'm definitely not trying. But you do get that funny taste in your mouth, don't you, if you do the battery thing? You
absolutely
get that taste that stays, yep, afterwards.
And so clearly this little device is doing something along those lines. I mean, I don't know what it does exactly. But.
And, Penn, I was wondering about historically, have people worried over the centuries about how much salt they're eating? Was there an idea that too much salt might be unhealthy or bad for you, or is that a new idea?
No, I mean, people for a long time, from the earliest writings about health, you know, in China, Egypt, people knew that salt had really useful properties, but they also knew that too much was an emetic or a laxative. And it's the concept of balance was incredibly important in ancient medicine. And so if something was salty, you would probably want to balance it with something else, something sweet, for example. And, you know, and there was this kind of idea that food was hot, cold, wet, dry. Salt was dry. And so if you're going to, you know, use salt, you should balance it with something else, with sugar or something, or cucumbers or something. And in ancient medicine, all food was medicine. And it's not just, I mean, salt was kind of fairly magical. You know, it had incredible kind of spiritual and magical properties. But everything had properties. You know, if you were depressed, you ate radishes. If you had toothache, you ate celery. If you needed to conceive children, you upped your turnip input. Everything has a property. And salt is really interesting because it's seen as a sort of semi-magical thing. You know, it has associations with fertility, for probably fairly obvious reasons, for longevity, because it's to do with food processing. But you often find it combined with other things, combined with honey or combined with oil or combined with herbs in kind of medicine or kind of the food that people ate with medicine. And so there's definitely a sense that too much of anything is bad for you, that balance is always the way to go with salt or any food, and that's a very long-standing idea.
Well, it sounds as though salt has been very important to human history and to the way we taste food and to our health. And, of course, in excess, it can be bad for you, as we've heard. We are breaking for the news now, but in the second part of the evidence, we'll talk about how much salt is too much salt, why the discussion around this issue is far from straightforward, and what we can do to make sure we are eating a healthy amount. Thank you so much, Penn Vogler, for joining us today. I'm Claudia Hammond, and I'll be back soon with more from Andrea Seller and DK Oji and a new guest in the evidence from the BBC. Hello, I'm Claudia Hammond. Welcome back to the Evidence from the BBC. I'm at Wellcome Collection in London with a live audience, and we've been talking about salt and the part it plays in our everyday lives. It makes our food taste good, and it's vital to our health. But what's the right amount of salt to eat, and why can this be a contentious issue? Well, to help me find out, I'd like to welcome to our panel Sue Matthews, who's a Professor of Health Economics at Lancaster University in the UK. And joining us from Nigeria, we have Dr. DK Oji, who's a practicing cardiologist and head of the cardiovascular research unit at the University of Abuja. And here with me, also in London, is Andrea Seller, who's professor of chemistry at University College London. So we're going to find out how much salt is too much and the best ways of cutting down on your salt intake if you eat too much of it at the moment. But before that, since you are all from different parts of the world on the panel, I wanted to ask each of you what sort of foods you ate growing up, and was there a lot of salt in them? Sue, what about you?
Well, as Portuguese, of course, I had bacalhau, cod fish. Okay, it's salted cod fish.
That's not quite salty, isn't it?
Yeah, it's put in water before it's cooked, so part of the salt is taken away, but it's salted. It's very good.
And DK, what about you? Did you eat a lot of salty foods when you were growing up?
Yeah, in a way. I mean, for us, salt is normally added to the food. So I remember when my grandma cooked or my mom, they always added salt. And on top of that, there is the bouillon also, which also contains salt. So you are actually consuming salt in two dimensions, the table salt itself and also the bouillon.
So the bouillon is what we call in lots of countries like a stock cube, the same kind of thing that gets crumbled and added into it. So yeah, as you say, it can be quite salty. And DK, we've discussed the harms of a diet that is high in salt, but what are you seeing in Nigeria at the moment in terms of diet when it comes to salt?
I mean, it's changing gradually because of rapid urbanization. People are eating more outside, and if you eat outside, then you don't really have control over the level of salt you are going to eat. People are also consuming more of the prepackaged food and processed food. Remember that most of them also have quite a lot of salt. We've heard this over and over again from Andre. That is the way you preserve most food. You have a lot of salt into them. So the more packaged food you eat, the more salt you consume. And so we are not surprised that we are seeing more of the high blood pressure, even in younger people, compared to what it used to be.
And DK, have you seen big changes in Nigeria over time? I don't know, over the last centuries?
Yeah, personally, we have seen big changes. I refer you to Donny Singh worked in Kenya, was one of the first cardiologists in Kenya. And when he got there, he said there was almost no high blood pressure. But as diet started changing, then from his report, he started seeing a trajectory of increased blood pressure in the population. The same thing we have seen over the time. I remember as a medical student in University of Ibadan, if you see a patient that is less than 40 years old coming in with high blood pressure, we just wanted to do a lot of extensive investigations. But now we are seeing high blood pressure in people that are less than 30 years. And you can do all the investigations to rule out if there is any secondary cause. And most time we just find nothing. The same pattern is happening all over the world. People are tending to eat more outside. People are eating more of the processed food or prepackaged food, which contains more salt. The World Health Organization recommendation is that you should not consume more than 5 grams of salt a day. So we found out that over 55% of the population we studied exceeded the daily requirement, you know, or recommendation by the World Health Organization in our own setting. And that is the same pattern we are seeing in different parts of the world.
Well, I thought I'd do a quick poll of the audience now. And what I'd like to know is how many of you worry about how much salt you eat? Can you cheer if you worry about how much salt you eat?
Yes.
Oh, yes, a bit of it. Now, to be fair, you're a self-selecting audience who's decided to come to an event on salt, so I get that this won't be representative. But I wonder how many of you are trying to reduce the amount of salt you eat. Can you cheer if you're trying to limit your salt?
Yes.
Yeah, quite a few people there. And so we've talked about this recommendation of 5 grams or a teaspoon a day. Sue, what is the evidence underpinning these guidelines? Where did this 5 grams come from?
Actually, I was rereading the studies before coming here, so preparing like for an exam.
Very good.
And, of course, the evidence was around, you know, that too much salt, well, above this threshold, would have a negative impact in your health because you'd have higher blood pressure, then you'd get cardiovascular diseases, then you can get stroke, then you are going to die younger. So that's bad. Avoid salt, even if you have high blood pressure, reduce your salt intake. But the evidence is there, but it's not very, very robust, okay? Meaning by this that we don't have those many trials. There are some studies, but just slightly more than 50% of the studies say that too much salt is bad. And so all the studies say that too much salt is bad. So what do the studies defend and what's the guidance about? It's about the reduction in salt in food and whether or not governments should promote a wide population reduction in salt as a measure of public health. So the evidence, what says that too much salt is bad, all the evidence says that, but where we have contradictory results is whether or not governments should act in such a way that to reduce salt in food as a public health measure. And the evidence there is not that strong because people that don't have high blood pressure don't need to reduce their salt intake. If you have a normal blood pressure, it means that you are okay and you should not be reducing your salt intake because then you are going to create other health problems.
And why are some studies contradicting each other over this? Have they been done in different ways?
Well, science is always done in different ways, okay? So, of course, that these studies weren't done by the same researchers, weren't done in the same countries, weren't done at the same time, in the same years, with exactly the same circumstances. So there are differences in these studies. But also what this study by Trinkard and colleagues published in 2016, what they found is that there is kind of a polarization of the evidence. So studies that find evidence that salt should be reduced in food and government should act on that way, they tend to cite each other, okay? So you have biased evidence because it's like an echo chamber. You know, people that think the same are saying, well, see, they also think the way I think, you know. And because you have several studies being published across many years, you get an higher impact of this. So you have like around 25-28% of researchers that publish around 70% of the evidence on each side. Okay, so it means that we are citing a lot the studies that say salt should be reduced as a public health measure, and we also have a lot of citations of studies that say no, we should not reduce salt for the white population as a public health measure. So again, the virtue is kind of in the middle. Too much salt is bad, but whether or not governments should act, so far with the evidence that was available until 2014, that wasn't the case, you know, for a public health measure in that direction.
TK, I wonder what you make of this debate about exactly how much salt is too much.
Well, I agree that it's a difficult terrain because you can have a lot of confounding factors. That is true. But then the best way to do is to do some meta-analysis or do a systematic review whereby you take a pool of studies and look at what has happened. And where this have happened, we are seeing that there is a favor to reducing salt. But we have a very, very good evidence from a salt substitute study led by Professor Bruce Nee of the Judge Institute. That was in China. And this population was over 5,000 persons. They gave them the risk, normal salt, sodium chloride. And in the other half, they reduced the sodium with potassium, what we call a salt substitute. They wanted to follow them up for about 4 years, but it has to be stopped after 3.5 years because the evidence were just too clear in favor of people that were taking salt substitute. Their blood pressure was much lower. They had lower level of stroke, heart attack, kidney failure, and so on. And they were really, really driven by high blood pressure. So if I go by this type of evidence, I will say that the lower the amount of salt you take, the better for you. Thank you.
Now, Andrea, it's really interesting, this idea of substituting some of the sodium with potassium. What do potassium and sodium have to do with each other in the body?
Well, sodium and potassium are kind of yin and yang in the body in many ways. Now, first of all, both of them are alkali metals. They sit above, one sits above the other. Sodium sits above potassium in the periodic table. So they have very, very similar chemistry, and they both have a 1+ charge. So this is important because it means that their chemistry is extremely similar. And biology doesn't simply use the salt to manipulate the water inside and outside cells, but at the same time, it works very hard to control the concentrations on one side of a membrane and another. And so there's a crucial sort of enzyme, well, it's called a pump, really, which is called the sodium-potassium ATPase. And what it does is it pumps sodiums in one direction and potassiums in the other. And so this is really important because you then set up a sort of difference in concentration of these two ions across the membrane, you can now start setting up voltages. And so those voltages, on the one hand, are quite useful because you can use them to transport nutrients into the cell and waste out of the cell. So you're using them essentially as a kind of energy source. But the other thing is, from a neurotransmission point of view, having a difference in concentration across the two then allows you to open little pores, little gates, which allow the salts to flood back across the membrane. And as they do so, you get a kind of pulse of voltage across. And that's what nerve signaling is all about. It's really about these flows of ions across the membrane, which then triggers things further along. And so in one place, the channels open, that causes the channels in the next bit and the next bit and the next bit. And so signals travel along. So sodium and potassium are essentially completely interlinked. And so while we worry a lot about getting enough sodium, and sodium is the familiar stuff because it's the bulk component of seawater, of sea salt, and so on, then potassium turns out to be extremely important. And so it turns out you can, in fact, make mixtures of sodium and potassium so that you can reduce the amount of sodium people take. And then the taste, well, I mean, it ought to be fairly similar.
Well, that's what we need to know. We need to know whether it tastes as good. And, of course, we're not allowed food here in the reading room at Wellcome Collection because this room is full of, you know, precious books and art and other artefacts, and we wouldn't want to get food all over those. But in a room nearby where we couldn't ruin anything, we did a bit of an experiment just before the show with some sort of solutions and all sorts that you brought in, Andrea. Can you tell us what you did, first of all?
So what I did was I made up five little solutions, essentially close to the concentration of seawater, so fairly strong. And what I did was I chose sodium chloride, that's table salt. I then took potassium chloride, so that's the non-sodium salt. Then just as a kind of control, I swapped the chloride, because, you know, when we talk about salt, we've been focused on the sodium, but there's the partner, which is the negatively charged bit, the chloride. So we went with sodium bromide. Then, as a complete outlier, I went to one place to the right in the periodic table and chose magnesium chloride. And finally, we had the mixture of sodium and potassium, which is marketed in supermarkets here as a kind of low sodium salt, replacement salt for people who have high blood pressure. And we tested it out. We did some animal experiments. We got a couple of animals. And we have.
And we didn't want to poison our audience with that list of things. So my BBC colleagues, Sophie and Caitlin, bravely volunteered, or we kind of made them, to taste what Andrea gave them. And they are here in the audience. So guinea pigs, how did it go? Sophie, what did you make of those different tastes?
I was surprised how different some of them tasted. So Andrea mentioned the magnesium chloride, that's only one along the periodic table, tasted awful. Really, really bad. Really, really bitter. Really different. But the low sodium salt, I couldn't really taste much difference between that and the table salt. In fact, I thought it tasted a bit nicer.
Which is interesting.
Yeah.
Caitlin, what about you? What did you think?
Yeah, I would agree. The low sodium mix of potassium and sodium was the least offensive. And in fact, when we had the potassium by itself, what was really interesting was it was really strong. It was more strong than the sodium chloride. So it seemed like you needed less of the potassium in some way. But hats off to the sodium and chloride mixture. That would be my vote.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, Andrea, how feasible would it be to replace all the table salt that gets eaten in the world with a mixture that's got potassium chloride in it as well?
It's feasible, but it would come at a cost. And one of the things is that there is less potassium around. I mean, you know, sodium is one of the most common elements in the Earth's crust. And I just think that it probably would be quite a hard sell. Maybe for people who are well off, fine and say it's health conscious, but I do wonder. And also being able to construct a whole distribution network where you say, okay, look, guys, sodium chloride is banned. You can now only have this mixture. Would it work? I wonder. I think it'd be expensive and probably unpopular and would generate conspiracy theories.
That's true. Sue, what about choosing to change your diet instead? Could you add more potassium to your diet, and by deliberately eating some of that, would that make a difference?
I think that the best way that we have to change our intake is to act on our diet and to cook at home from scratch, you know, and to monitor, you know, the salt that you put in the food. So it's difficult, but I think that we should have some agency and we should reflect and try to change the way that we are eating, because no one wishes to die young, okay, and we all like to live very long and healthy lives. And we know that in 2019, more than 30% of the deaths were caused by cardiovascular disease. And the highest risk, the first risk of death for cardiovascular disease was high blood pressure. So it's not that that we are the only responsible for our health, but it's something that we can change, because we can start to try to change one thing at once. Then, you know, usually, and this happens also when people start doing physical activity, then you also get into other behaviors, you know, that go into what is seen, the right direction in order to keep a healthy body, okay, and live a longer life with health-related quality of life. That's what we all wish, you know, when we are getting old, but also being able to benefit and to get joy from the life that we are living.
I mean, changing your diet is hard, though, isn't it? There was a study a couple of years ago in Japan which found that people with high blood pressure tended still not to reduce their salt intake and just relied on the medication once they'd been diagnosed.
Yes, it's very difficult to change a habit, okay? We usually tell to all, you know, to others, well, you should do this, you should do that. But when we try to change something that we have been doing for a long time, we realize that it's very different. And I think that sometimes it's the way that the message is given to patients, okay? Because if it's too radical, so you should stop eating salt. You know, people have it the first, you know, have two or three meals, and then they say, I can't stay with this for the rest of my life, okay? And then they stop doing it. So it's kind of, it's also trying to find a way to get people into changing some behaviors, you know, at some time, and set it up maybe like a trial. Well, try to do, you know, to reduce the amount of salt that you are having for 3 months, and then see if you can do with a bit less, you know, and then if you can decrease a bit more after, if you are in a situation that you need to reduce your salt intake, because if you are not, you don't need to change, okay?
Well, thank you for that. We're going to throw things open to the audience now. And can I get Penn? Could you come back and join us, please? So if you have any questions for Penn or Andrea or Sue or, of course, DK in Nigeria, do put your hand up. Yes, there's a question just there in the middle.
Hiya. So my question is, in the past, when they relied on sort of curing more as a preservative method, surely they would have had a high salt intake compared to, well, maybe the same as us today or even higher. So why wasn't high blood pressure and things such an issue for them then? Is it because, well, they just weren't able to diagnose them, or is it the salt in combination with something else in our modern diet that's why it's so bad for us?
That's an interesting question. I mean, Penn, is that something you've come across historically?
What about the level of salt? So it's interesting because our intake of salt goes up massively from, you know, throughout history, and it's probably at a maximum in probably the mid 19th century, you know, when people are relying on, you know, salt's getting increasingly cheaper, and then people are relying on preserved food because they're becoming much more urbanized, particularly in Britain and kind of urbanizing areas. And the evidence is that when you get other ways of preserving food, so freezing, canning and all those other things, and then also kind of preservative comes in, our need for salt reduces a lot, but our appetite for it doesn't. But we might be eating less salt now than we did in, the, say, the 19th century. I think one of the major differences is probably what that salt is attached to. So the ultra-processed food that Sue is talking about, it has the salt and it has the sugar, and actually not that many macro or micronutrients, whereas, you know, food in the past, you might have had salted fish or salted meat or cheese, and it all comes with quite a lot more, you know, protein, fat, nutrients and all the rest of it. That and that's probably the major difference between the way that we take salt in now and the way we've taken salt in the past.
Yes. Sue?
Yeah, I also want to say something. It's also people used to die younger, so they before they would get high blood pressure, because people would die from infectious disease. Well, women would die when they were giving birth, okay? So a lot of women would die before, you know, before 25 years old, because they would start having kids quite early in their lives. Well, that was it. And men would die, you know, also in with other diseases and work-related injuries and accidents and stuff like that. So people would live on average until 50 years old or 60 years old. And it was all, you know, before they could be diagnosed with high blood pressure and dying from cardiovascular disease. Because a lot of the diseases that we are having today, we are fortunate, you know, to have those diseases, because it means that we are living much longer lives. So we live until ages where those diseases can be diagnosed and can be treated. That's why we keep on living, you know, in spite of having high blood pressure, diabetes, kidney failure, well, the list is endless.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, that it's a really important point, this question of longevity. And salt, in fact, helped in a way to bring real sort of food prosperity. The discovery of cod by the Portuguese off the Grand Banks ensured that there was this enormous sort of funnel of protein that came into Europe. And you know, Seo mentioned bacalhau. In Italy, we call it bacalà, but in Northern Europe, it's called stockfish. And in Italy, the word comes through again, stocafiso. And so, although, yes, it would have brought in a bit of extra salt, on the other hand, it provides protein, right, which was otherwise in very short supply. And so, yes, this point that we're quite lucky to be getting heart disease now, it's kind of a luxury, really, to have to worry about salt intake.
Thank you for that. Who else has a question they'd like to ask? Yes, there's somebody just here.
Is it possible to never add salt to our food and be okay?
Oh, that's an interesting question. DK, if people never added salt to their food, would they still get enough?
Thank you very much. So I have patients that will reduce their salt intake in their food. These are high blood pressure patients. And they tell you, I don't even take any salt. I said, so how do you cope? What are the things? They said they've gotten conditioned to it. Not one, not two, not three. Especially teachers. I see that teachers, for me, most of my patients tend to be very, very compliant. They keep a diary of their blood pressure, the food they have taken, and so on. So I have a couple of them like, and they say, I don't consume salt. And then you check their electrolyte, urine, and creatinine, where you can get the sodium level, you get the chloride level, and they are virtually normal. Why is it so? It is so because the food they are consuming already has sodium. So they don't need to add salt, you know, to the food they eat at all. Mind you, they might have added some bouillon also, which already contains salt. So in a way, there's a lot of overload because every food you consume, from the bread you take, they already contain salt. So if you can eat and it tastes well, you know, it is very, very possible not to add food to the food you eat or even at the table, and your sodium level still remains the same. That is my practical experience, you know, within some of my patients.
Thank you. Well, we are out of time, but it turns out there is a lot more to salt than you might think. We think it's this really basic thing, but actually there's all sorts of complexities in it. Well, thank you so much to our panel tonight. Andrea Seller from University College London, food historian Penn Vogler, DK OG from the University of Abuja, and Sue Matthews from Lancaster University in the UK. This show is made in collaboration with Wellcome Collection. And thank you to our studio engineers today, Emma Hart and Andrew Garrett, and to the production team, Margaret Sessa Hawkins and Liz Tui. And thank you to all of you in the audience for coming along today. I'm Claudia Hammond, and to hear more on global health, do join me every week on the BBC World Service for Health Check. Bye for now.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that makes using different currencies easy. With Wise, you can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate. There are no hidden fees either. See exactly what you'll pay up front, every time. Join 16 million customers already saving with Wise. To learn how Wise could work for you, download the app or visit wise.com.
He would appear in the dark.
He hunted at night, terrorizing his victims.
He was a killer.
He killed so many, he lost count.
The whole scale of it is just, it's mesmerizing.
But he's no longer behind bars. He's free. And now he's ready to talk.
I'm not that monster that the people say I am.
World of Secrets from the BBC World Service. Season 3, The Apartheid Killer. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.